There's no one in that room there who knows what they're going to think next until the thought itself arises. Everybody think of a film. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of movies you know. Think of one. Now, whatever you thought of, it is an absolute mystery as to why you thought of that. I mean, even if you have a story about why you thought of it, the truth is there were dozens, there were hundreds of films you could have thought of, but you didn't. And to say you could have thought of them, it's a kind of illusion, in that if we return your brain to the state it was in a moment ago, you would have produced exactly the same film memory as you did, and you would do that a trillion times in a row.
You gave the example earlier of, you know, you're a different person when you speak to your mother than when you do to the police. And that seems
I'm not always talking to the police. I'm just an example. Just an example.
And the thought there is, right, we all know we have different aspects of our personality, but we still think it's the same me, the same entity which was there 10 years ago, 10 minutes ago, 10 seconds ago. It's the same me throughout time there. So I wonder what you think more particularly about whether or not we could have multiple of those entities which are me throughout time in one brain. So, for example, you get people with like schizophrenia who feel like they've got multiple inner voices in their heads, people with Cotard syndrome who feel as if they're dead or they're having the thoughts of someone who's passed away, and they don't feel like those thoughts are their thoughts but someone who's deceased. Like, are those examples, where those I guess fringe or difficult examples, do they give us a clue as to whether or not there can be multiple things that we would call a self within one person's body?
I think if you think about it, probably at any one point in time, those selves could be very different. We are projecting, like, the performative elements of social behaviour, which is everything. Talking is a performance. Getting dressed in the morning is a performance. We are going out into our social world and trying to present the faces, to be seen the way we wish to be seen. That's a strong element of what we mean by self. And indeed, people with aphasia call it often identity theft, because you can't do it. You can't talk the way you used to. You sound different. Everyone's making assumptions about you based on what you sound like. So that's a really big feature of it. But I think your point about, like, aging, I found my diary from when I was 16, and I thought, oh, this is going to be hilarious. And it was like it had been written by a total stranger. Every so often, something happened in it that I recognised. Oh, hang on. And it was because me at 15 and 16 had a totally different narrative around my life than me in my 50s, looking back at me at 16, and the stories I'd want to tell about it. I would remember those years. I could tell you things about it. So I am the same person. The illusory aspects of the self, as Sam has talked about, I think are kind of feeding in, you know, the sense of continuity, but actually, manifestly, I'm not the same. I am not the same. And minute to minute, based on emotion, based on context, you will be behaving differently. You will be having different experiences of yourself because of how things will change very quickly, because we're not like a ship sailing steadily through, you know, smooth waters, but we are affected by events all the time. And you are going to inevitably, because of your both the factors about who you want to be in the world and how the world is being around you and how you're feeling about it, will affect that's the self that you are being at that moment.
Sam, I was flicking through your book on spirituality recently, and you give this great example at the start of your chapter on the self, where you say you were visiting the sermon where Jesus gave his lengthiest, visiting the mount where Jesus gave his lengthiest sermon, and you said you had the spiritual experience in which you say, I no longer felt separate from the scene, peering out at the world behind my eyes. And you spoke about that a moment ago, that we have this feeling of self looking out at the world from inside, and that can disappear. But what does it mean to, like, see the world from somewhere other than behind my eyes? Like, what other kind of perspective experientially can I gain which doesn't feel as if I'm sitting in the theater watching these experiences happen on the screen?
Yeah, well, so the conventional sense of subject-object dualism is, again, to feel like you're the subject. Right? And again, this is not the same thing as feeling like you're your body, because most people don't feel that. They feel that they're aware of their bodies as a kind of object. If you think about what the brain is doing, you're representing a world, right? Like everything you take to be the world is, in fact, a kind of neurological vision, right? It's a, you know, this is all, everything you see with your open eyes is in fact realized as a state of your brain, right? This is almost like a video game playing computer, right? And this is the model of the world you're experiencing, but you're not in touch with the world as it is outside of your brain at this moment, right? So what you see with your open eyes is appearing in the same place where your thoughts and feelings and sensations and memories are appearing. And you can, with your open eyes, you can broadcast a visual experience right now into the room or into that tent. I mean, just visualize a horse walking through across the stage right now. Some people are better at this than others. Some people get just the faintest of image, but it's or more or less nothing. But for everyone, there'll be a difference between visualizing a horse versus visualizing an elephant or visualizing a peacock, right? So there's something happening there, and it's being superimposed on what you see with your open eyes, right? It's being registered in visual cortex. This is being driven top down by your frontal lobes. So it's all a vision, right? But in addition to this sense of representing a world and representing our body in the world, we represent a sense of self interior to the body. And for the most part, we do that in the head, right? So there's a sense of subject inside the body that's not identical to it. And then there's the bodies in the world and almost a part of the world. That's the illusion. But so much of what has been described so far is not illusory. I mean, there's a difference between being able to remember your past and not, right? I mean, spending each moment as though you've just woken up from a coma because you have such a comprehensive, brain injury, that's very different than knowing what you had for breakfast and remembering who you were last week and feeling some sense of psychological continuity with your past. And all of those capacities can be preserved or not, unrelated to this concept of being an unchanging subject in the middle of experience, which is the thing that I think is vulnerable to inspection, which actually doesn't make any neurophysiological sense either. Because when you think about what a brain is, there's no part of it that is truly unchanging, right? There is this, it is a kind of process, right? It's a neurophysiological electrochemical process that changes in almost every way. Not entirely at the level of cell bodies, the way that the lining of your gut does, but in terms of it's a river of sorts itself, right? So there's just nothing that's being carried through moment to moment that is this crystalline cell that is the same thing that looked out through your eyes when you were 16. Though you can't remember any of what you felt at that point, and feel that the author of your journal is a stranger to you, and it's the same, person looking out through your eyes now. No, that self doesn't exist, but consciousness exists. Consciousness, and that consciousness, I think, at bottom, once you strip away all of the particulars of its contents, is a kind of impersonal reality, and it's which is to say that if we could swap consciousnesses, nothing would change. If we could swap memories and the contents of consciousness, everything would change.
Roger, the consciousness is the, if we're going to have a self, it seems like it needs to, like, what the fundamental thing is that makes us selves. You say it's consciousness. So presumably you think consciousness sits at the bottom somewhere in terms of what's fundamental in reality. Because if it was the brain producing consciousness, and the brain and the physical particles were fundamental, you'd go selves are brains. So is that right? Do you think the consciousness is more fundamental, let's say, than the things described by physics?
No, I don't think that. I mean, I'm not sure what I think here, if you really ask me. I think we have to explore. I'm a sort of physicist, so I know more about physics than I know about brain structure or brain function. But I dabble in that area, and I have this slightly strange or unusual view that whatever consciousness is that it's something beyond the sort of current view we have of physics. But it does connect directly with this really ill-understood phenomenon of the collapse of the wave function. So there is something which bridges quantum scale to classical scale. And you wouldn't get a classical world out of quantum mechanics if it weren't for this collapse of the wave function. some people think of it as a sort of fictional thing which comes about because of some conscious observer looking at the system. I don't believe that at all. I think it's a physical process which goes on quite irrespective of whether there are conscious beings around or not. Nevertheless, I do think that consciousness is somehow exploiting that aspect of physical laws that we don't fully understand yet. And that has to do with the collapse of the wave function, because only there can we see something beyond a computable behavior. And so my argument was that understanding things is not a computation, despite what people who do AI and stuff these days, that there's something other than things you can put on a computer. When I say computation, I mean something you could put on a computer. I mean, there's a technical mathematical definition of what it means, but that's more or less what it means. A computer with an unlimited storage space, put it like that. But there is a limit to what can be achieved by such things. And what you can do beyond that is what you use your conscious understanding for. So, which tells me that there is something beyond the computable picture that we have of most of physics these days. And we actually harness that for consciousness. Now, to what extent that answers the problem of the self, I think from what you just pointed out to me, and I agree, it has something to do with sewing together on a bead. Each one's a bead, and then you have it all strung together on a string of beads. And is that whole thing an entity in itself, which is the self in a certain sense, rather than the individual beads, which would be our conscious experience as any one moment? Of course, that changes from moment to the next. And people with these conditions of the brain, which are very unpleasant to hear about. But then there are a lot of questions that are unanswered at the moment, and sometimes people, more physically minded people, say, oh, that's not a real question. And let me give you an example. Is the experience of the color blue the same that I have in some sense as the same that you have when you see a blue thing? Now, people would normally say, well, it's all to do with conscious experience and blah, 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 blah. And you can't really answer that question. I'm inclined to think there probably is an answer to that question, that in some sense there is something which is actually present in the sensation of blueness, which is common to other people as well. And it will be related also to this phenomenon of synesthesia, where different parts of the brain seem to get mixed up with other functions of the other parts of the brain. And somehow, I think that gives you some clues to what's going on there. So you can, the actual sensation of something is not the same, really, as how you react to it.
Right.
Something like that.
So, but in short, though, you want to go, so we have these, we have information processing, computational processes in our brains.
Yes.
But there's something outside of that that can't be mirrored by like a large language model like ChatGPT or something, which is understanding it. Like in Searle's Chinese Room, process this information.
Yes.
But there's clearly a problem that physics can't address as we currently know, which is what is it to have the experience of understanding something?
That's right. And the argument that I got, well, I really formed this view when I was a graduate student. And I went to a course of lectures by a man called Steen, which has nothing to do with what I was supposed to be doing. And he taught me about what the notion of computability meant, sort of Turing machines and things like that, and what Gödel's theorem said. And I was absolutely stunned, because the Gödel theorem says a certain sentence is true, and you can see it's true, even though it's not derivable by the rules that you put in. You say, what do I mean by proof? I mean following these rules. Okay, it's not right, really, because you see a certain statement which you can see must be true by virtue of your believing that these rules give you only truths, which transcends the use of the rules. Now, what does it mean to believe that these rules only give you truths? Well, that's through your understanding of something. So it really tells me that the quality of understanding something goes beyond what can be achieved by a computer.
Okay, good. Let's bring Sam back in on this discussion as well. So, Sam, the last major topic of our discussion is whether or not we can have such a thing as moral responsibility and personal rights if we're getting rid of this idea of the self altogether. So I'm interested for your views on that, how it works out practically and ethically. But also, at the same time, I do want to push you on this question, which this view that Roger's been presenting there, which is, why can't you say that we are simply just our conscious experiences? You don't deny that consciousness exists. You say it's not illusory. Why not say that these fleeting conscious experiences are what selves are?
Well, that's fine, but that's just not how most people feel themselves to be in moment to moment, right? So I think you are identical. Again, as a matter from the first person side, as a matter of experience, there's simply experience, right? You're identical to experience, but most people feel like they're almost like they're on the bank of a river, watching the contents of consciousness go by, as though they were on the edge of experience. You know, you're either in the center of your experience, you're on the edge of it, but you're not identical to it. Whereas in reality, there's only the river, right? You are the river. You're not watching it. You're not in a boat on top of it. You're identical to it, and yet most people don't feel that most of the time. And when you do feel that, when you lose your sense of being separate from experience, when you lose your sense of looking over your own shoulder in each moment from the edge of your experience, that's quite a, for many people, it can be scary, but for you know, most people, it's quite a thrilling experience of self-transcendence, right? That is the basis of virtually all of our contemplative mysticism and certainly esoteric religious aspiration, right? So there's a vast literature about how good experience gets when you can stop feeling like you're separate from it, right? So that's, yes, to answer your question, I think we are identical to consciousness and its contents in each moment, and there's no real duality between those two things. I mean, there's what you're calling the contents of consciousness in each moment is an expression of consciousness. It's like the images in a mirror being inseparable from the reflective quality of the mirror, or waves in an ocean being inseparable from the water. It's like the waves aren't properly thought of as objects in the ocean. They're expressions of the ocean. And so, again, I'm not making metaphysical claims about how all of this relates to the Big Bang or to physical reality. I'm just talking about the character of experience when you pay sufficiently close attention to it. As for moral responsibility, when you lose a sense of self, you notice that thoughts and even the most deliberate acts of willing simply arise on their own, right? I mean, there's no one in that room there who knows what they're going to think next until the thought itself arises, right? I mean, you can just perform this experiment on yourself. Just everybody think of a film. You know, just wait. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of movies the titles of. Think of one. Now, whatever you thought of, it is an absolute mystery as to why you thought of that. I mean, even if you have a story about why you thought of it, the truth is there were dozens or hundreds of films you could have thought of, but you didn't. And to say you could have thought of them is a kind of illusion, in that if we rewound your experience, you know, if we returned your brain to the state it was in a moment ago, you would have produced exactly the same film memory as you did. And you would do that a trillion times in a row. And if you add randomness to this picture, it still doesn't give you the free will people think they have, because, you know, that's just, you know, randomness is not what people imagine they have when they really believe they have agency. Yeah. So I think when you look at people's behavior, even, you know, morally important behavior like committing murders, you have to see that everyone on some level is a force of nature, right? They didn't make themselves. They didn't make their genes. They didn't make the environment to which their genes their genes were influenced. And the combination of genes and environment are precisely what created the states of their brain prior to their last action. But this doesn't mean that everyone gets off by reason of insanity. I mean, the fact is, we still need to lock people away in prison when they're too dangerous to let out of prison, right? But the crucial point morally is that if we had a cure for psychopathy, right, if we had a cure for human evil, if we totally understood it at the level of the brain, we would just give the cure, right? And we wouldn't think it would make any moral sense to withhold the cure from psychopaths, because they really deserve to be in prison and to remain psychopaths. We would recognize that psychopathy is on some basic level a derangement of the brain, and we would cure that in the same way we would cure diabetes or anything else we would want to cure for people. And it's the fact that the actual causes of the worst forms of immoral behavior are still mysterious to us, that we attribute them to the agent and imagine that the agent should have complete control mm-hmm. over who he or she is, when we know that no one made themselves, right? And no yeah. one brought their brain to the precise moment it was in a moment ago.
Well, I'm interested to hear Sophie's view on that in particular. So to the end of Sam's argument, there seems to be one that Galen Strawson's quite popular for. You do what you do because of the way you are. You can't be responsible for how you are, so you can't be responsible for what you do. Does that resonate with you from a neuroscientific perspective?
I mean, I have to say, in a neuroscientific or a biological perspective, we do have a biological model for criminal behavior. It's called the Y chromosome. No, I'm not being funny. There are like 23 to like, for every woman in prison, there are 23 men. That's worse than engineering departments. It's extraordinary. We do know this. This is found throughout nature. It seems to be a function of testosterone, possibly, which there's a really interesting interaction between testosterone and dopamine. They amplify each other. So men seem to get like bigger payoffs from sexual activity, for example, probably through this route. But sexual behavior is different in males and females. Aggressive behavior is different in males and females. And what we do with this is we ignore it and we pretend it's not true and that people have made moral failings. So I think, again, going back to us as social creatures, we need to live in environments where we have social norms. We, all human communities, the social norms can be different, but they are there. And we have to have them because otherwise the behavior would be, not only from the men, unacceptable, but it's also something that makes kind of the politeness norms make normal interactions feasible. So this is not a brain answer. This is a biology, psychology answer. And this is not disagreeing with anything that's been said so far, but I think one of the things that is really interesting from a brain perspective is how much we are and are not conscious of and what neural systems it's associated with. So everybody here is sitting on a chair and not falling straight to the floor because of postural reflexes that continuously adjust how we're sitting and how we're standing and stop us from falling. And we have almost no conscious awareness of that. When things go wrong with it, you then are very quickly aware of it. And similarly, if you're walking down the street and you trip, by the time you've had time to think I'm tripping, your sensory motor systems, again, over which you have very little conscious awareness, are the ones that are correcting the trip. And if you were to wait for conscious awareness, you'd be lying on the floor with your face on the pavement going, I have fallen, because that is not going to save you. So there's a interesting functional distinctions to be made at a brain level, which are interacting with the kind of moral questions right through to sort of the physical stuff of how we're able to move about in the world, which really do intersect with what's, and I'm not in any way denying the importance of consciousness. I'm just saying there are very interesting things that we don't have good conscious access to. And I think that is interesting when we start to look at brain systems, because from a brain kind of networks perspective, there do seem to be some networks with it, for example, the ones in the temporal lobes, over which we have a lot more conscious awareness than other stuff that's, for example, kind of integrating body and movement.
Well, Roger, maybe you can give a slightly different perspective here, or maybe you won't and you'll agree as well, but maybe your view has more room for allowing for something like agency or libertarian free will, if you want to say that consciousness...
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.